the three parshiyots, Devarim, Vetchanan, and Ekev. That brings us up to parsha number 4, which is chapter 11, verse 26. Again, keep in mind that this division into parshiyot, to some degree, is artificial, because it's in the middle of a speech. In other words, it's not like a new parsha does not automatically mean a new topic. In fact, very often it just continues more of the same. We're still in a discourse, a farewell discourse of Moshe before his death. In fact, it's very interesting that the whole division of the Torah into parshiyot, meaning this is how much we read every week, is not the only way to divide the Torah. The original division of the Torah reading, which I understand some Reformed congregations have actually tried to reinstitute, is the Torah was finished every 3 years, meaning that our division, which finishes the Torah every Simchat Torah, so you finish it once a year, was not the original division of the Torah. The original Eretz Yisrael, Kriyat HaTorah, finished the Torah in 3 years. Now, that is a little different. Some Reformed congregations have done that, but they do it in a different way. In other words, what some congregations do is the following. They will read on week number 1, 1/3 of Parshat Bereshit. Week number 2, 1/3 of Parshat Noach. Week number 3, 1/3 of Lech Lecha. So they still try to finish every Parsha in a year, and then next year they'll start from the middle. That was not the way it was done. The way it was done was week 1 Bereshit, week 2 Bereshit, week 3 Bereshit. You finished the whole thing. Then you went on to Noach. Now, that should reinforce to us really an obvious point, but a point that sometimes escapes us. And that is, you might ask the following question. If the Torah was read, was not finished for 3 years, then what was the annual significance of the holiday that we know as Simchat Torah? The Torah was not finished on Simchat Torah. The answer is, the original concept of the holiday of Simchat Torah is, it is simply day 2 of the holiday called Shmini Atzeret, meaning, for example, in Israel, there is no separate day called Simchat Torah. There is a holiday after Sukkot that is called Shmini Atzeret, and outside of Israel, just like all holidays, because of calendrical uncertainties, are 2 days. So Simchat Torah is really, just like the second day of Pesach, or the 8th day of Pesach, or the 2nd day of Shavuot, Simchat Torah is the 2nd day of Shmini Atzeret. And in fact, if you look in the prayer book, you will see when we say, you know, God should give us, you know, Moadim L'Simcha, so we don't say, Et Yom Simchat HaTorah Hazeh. We say, Et Yom Shmini Chag HaTzeret Hazeh. So it's very interesting that the concept of the 2nd day of Shmini Atzeret being a day of the conclusion of the Torah is a much, much later tradition. It is not the original idea of the holiday. The original idea of the holiday was it's simply Shmini Atzeret, which we'll talk about what that is. But it does not have to be automatically connected with the Siyum HaTorah, especially since they were working on a 3-year cycle. But basically, when the Rambam, Maimonides, was the rabbi of Cairo, there were still two minyanim, there were two synagogues in Cairo. One, which followed the Babylonian rite of finishing the Torah in a year, and the other following the ancient Palestinian rite of finishing the Torah in 3 years. But eventually, there basically is no custom to do that anymore, and even the Reform innovation is following a different type of 3-year cycle. Not the same one that we're talking about. Okay. But anyway, be it as it may, the parsha begins really continuing with the theme of calling upon the Jewish people to keep the mitzvot. But in Re'eh, there's going to be a very sharp transition. We're going to see very shortly, after some introductory verses, that Moshe is no longer going to be concerned with history or general statements of belief in God and faith, but he's now going to concretize it in halacha and mitzvot. Of course, we've had a number of mitzvot, tefillin, mezuzah, and the like, but there's going to be a lot of specific mitzvot, and Parshat Re'eh is one of the richest parshiot in the Torah in terms of the number of commandments that are in this parsha, some of which are relatively unfamiliar to people, and we will look at them. But he begins with a general verse, which is a very important idea. Riei, again chapter 11, verse 26. Riei, look, ponder. Anochi notein lifnechem hayom. I, this is Moses talking, I am placing before you today a blessing and a curse. The idea of the two roads. First of all, it's very important. You'll notice that Riei is Lashon Yachid. Riei is singular. It's not Re'u. And there are two reasons for this. One reason is because every single individual has to make the choice to serve God or not to serve God. There is no safety in numbers, in one sense. In other words, you can't say, well, I belong to a synagogue where everybody does mitzvot, therefore, or I give money to this organization, therefore. God's call is to each individual to make those decisions. And that is the Riei, the blessing and the curse. It's all up to us. The second reason why it may say Lashon Yachid is almost the opposite direction. And it's suggesting that the idea of unity and love and Ahavat Yisrael, so that each of us become like one, meaning we're not a bunch of disparate individuals, but in unity we become one. You know, you always have the situation of the parent on their deathbed calls their children together and say, you know, care about each other, be one. Well, this is what Moshe is doing. Moshe is on his deathbed, and he's calling his children together, all, well, 600,000 men, so there must be 3 million men, women, children there. And he's saying, be together, care about each other, don't fight, don't make machlokets. This is the Riei. But you'll notice there's a very interesting shift. Look at the pasuk. The pasuk itself is grammatically inconsistent. Riei anochi notein lifneichem. Now lifneichem means in front of you, but it's plural. So really, it should have said either re'u anochi notein lifneichem, or in the alternative, riei anochi notein lifanecha. Okay, this is a switch in mid-verse between the singular and the plural. And maybe, again, this is just a suggestion, a speculation, maybe it highlights the idea that in the service of God, there is both the imperative of community, meaning we have to obliterate our differences and come together, but there is also the concept of individuality and uniqueness. In other words, one of the tensions in religious life, and life generally, is to what degree does community call upon me to sometimes give up my idiosyncratic ways, my individuality, my uniqueness, and kind of become part of the group. Becoming part of a group involves a certain amount of sacrifice. In other words, you don't do everything you want to do. And yet, in the service of God, there is a concept that on one hand, we stress community, in which everybody comes together to do the same thing, but we also recognize the concept of uniqueness and individuality in one's service of God. In fact, one can make the argument that the imperative of community precisely comes from the fact that since everyone is unique and different, the beauty of the tapestry is created only when each one has a different color that they contribute. Meaning to say that community is not designed to produce a conformity or a monochromatic type of Judaism, but community is designed to allow each segment to have an input and to have a beauty. So the shift from individual, in other words, here's the individual term, the Lashon Yachid suggests we become like one, but the plural will suggest the idea of diversity and differentiation. That in the service of God, there have to be these two ideas. Again, in the classroom, since many of you are teachers, you could certainly see this, in which a classroom generally has a common lesson plan, a common agenda, a common set of goals. That's what you do in a class. But at the same time, a teacher has to be responsive to the individual learning styles, the individual needs of students. Certain students don't take in information the same way other people take them in. Certain people, whether they're adults or children, are not moved by the same thing. Some people find their connection to God through the most arcane technical studies in Limud HaTorah. In other words, the great rabbis find endless fascination, endless joy in the most subtle, impractical issues of life. In fact, sometimes the more theoretical it is, the more enjoyable it is. You know, you get rid of the messiness of everyday life, and one puts themselves into a world of pure thought. Others are more earthy by orientation, and they like to see the practical impact of Judaism on the way they live their lives. Others are less intellectually inclined, and they find in music or singing or prayer, they find ways of being close to God. One of the great tragedies, in a sense, you know, Jews like to boast, and rightly so, that we were the first society in the world that had compulsory education for children. This was recorded over 2,000 years ago. School systems were set up where children had to learn. And this, there was no society in the world that required youngsters to go to schools. So the emphasis of education, of course the education there was Limud HaTorah, was something that's very, very deeply embedded in the Jewish soul. And yet if you look at the original Talmudic passage that discusses this education, you actually see that it was regarded as kind of a second best. Originally, every parent would teach their children. Homeschooling was the original method. And this is based on the verse in the Shema, "V'shinantam levanecha," you shall teach your children. Their concept is a parent teaches a child. A parent gives the child the tradition. However, in the course of time, as is certainly the case today, and it was even the case then, not all parents were capable of teaching their children. Either they didn't have time, or they didn't have patience, right? We know that even if parents have the time and the ability, sometimes, on some level, parents are not necessarily, at least in a formal sense, they're not necessarily the best teachers. For example, it's well established sociologically that you shouldn't teach your kid how to drive. You know, give it to a driving teacher. So for whatever reason, parents were not always able to be the formal teacher, although obviously they are the great informal teachers, and therefore schools were created. But why are parents ideally better than schools? Because every student is separate. Every human being is separate. There's individuality. When you're giving a class to 30 or 20 people, one has to find a common denominator, but that's not necessarily the particular hook. And therefore, there is a concept of individuality, and the great difficulty of the classroom is how do you create a common learning environment and at the same time be responsive to the individual. Now the Pasuk is not giving us an answer to this, but the Pasuk is simply alluding in a very subtle way to the notion that within the formation of communities, whether they be synagogue communities, religious communities, school communities, there is both the concept of cohesiveness and identity and camaraderie, common goals, but also the notion of individuality and uniqueness.
Just an aside, back of that up for a few years ago, I took an education course in sort of theories of learning, and some studies were done, and there is really a much better outcome, just in terms of cognitive learning, I'm not talking about values or testing cognitive learning, on one-to-one over any style.
Yeah.
Yeah, one-to-one in that entire.
Yeah, well, you know, I understand that, but you know, what can you do? To have a teacher-student ratio of one-to-one is very, very difficult.
Right, they weren't that poor.
No, I understand, but it makes the point, yeah.
Academic study that is...
Absolutely. I mean, I know myself when I was in Israel 2 years ago for a few weeks, and, you know, my son was out of school, so I would learn with him a little bit. And like what we did in a half an hour was kind of, you know, what they do the whole day in school, and you know, it was just as good. But but the point is that what teachers have to try to do is to approximate to the degree possible, and it's only a very, very attenuated degree possible, that concept of bringing out the individual. You know, there's a marvelous story, I'm sure you've heard it, it's probably a well-known educational parable, but a story about a school for animals in which, I don't remember all the details, but you know, the rabbit had to go to school and the eagle had to go to school, and each one was very good in something. The eagle could soar and the rabbit could burrow, etc. But the school required that everybody takes the same courses. So the eagle had to take swimming and the snake had, you know. So each one was like very excellent in one particular thing, but they weren't very good in the other. So the school required extra hours be put in. So at the end of the year, everybody was mediocre in everything. So the eagle couldn't fly that well anymore, but at least it was mediocre in tree climbing. You know. So the parable about the educational system is that we do have to a large degree, a one-size-fits-all, which sometimes requires that one sacrifices the excellence in one area in order to achieve a mediocrity in a large number of areas. And, you know, it's a very, very difficult question. I know that even in Chumash, let me give you an example, many people are not verbal learners, meaning, the study of Jewish texts is primarily, you know, verbal learning. One reads, one thinks, one analyzes that way. But some, let's say, have the minds of the architect, let's say, where they see things in pictures, and they don't really see things through words. And yet the truth of the matter is, there is so much in Jewish learning that can be communicated through those alternative ways. For example, you have details about the Mishkan, about the tabernacle, which are very architectural and three-dimensional. And a lot of, you know, verbal learners who are very good in Talmudic analysis find it difficult to visualize things in three dimensions. And sometimes teachers will tell you in the Jewish day schools that kids that were falling asleep for all sorts of things all of a sudden come alive when you're dealing with constructing models and things like that. So one has to find a way to somehow integrate those different learning styles. Again, this is a digression, but the point is that the Torah sometimes communicates this in very subtle word shifts. That's what one has to read. You wouldn't even see this in English, right? Because in English, see, an English translation doesn't differentiate between second person singular and second person plural. They're both either you or thou. But in Hebrew, one has to pay very close attention. And then one tries to say, well, gee, what could be the message in the shift from plural to singular, singular to plural, etc. There is another comment that Rashi makes, which is very beautiful, that Moshe says, I am giving you a blessing today. Hayom. What day is that? So the simple explanation is, well, the day that he happens to be talking. But Rashi says no. Every time you read this verse, Hayom is today, the day that you're reading it. Meaning to say, every single day we wake up in the morning and we have the opportunity of choosing the blessing or the curse. Now that's extremely significant. Again, this is the reflective of the popular saying, this is the first day of the rest of your life. Meaning, no matter what happened yesterday, no matter how far afield you may have gone in whatever is destructive, every day there is the new opportunity to rectify, to repair, to grow, to make the choice. In other words, Hayom is the great message that people are not locked in to the patterns of their past, and a human being can go beyond it. It also means, the challenge is, however, it also means you don't rest in your laurels. And the fact that, you know, you've done a lot of good things doesn't really allow us, as it were, to retire from the field of goodness. But we have to make the choice every day. So it's both a challenge and a comfort. It challenges the person not to rest on their laurels and live a life of complacency. But the comfort is, you're not locked into what you were yesterday. There is this capacity of change, and that is the notion of Hayom.
Yeah, you were saying that, I mean, I think I don't believe everybody's story. I mean, if you turn into the movie, the news, Christopher Reeves, yep. Book.
Yep.
And to listen to this guy, I mean, I really, yesterday I was doing some stuff like South Korea, this one. Like, east side of mission, east side of vision. It's unbelievable to listen to this guy. He's captivating. And this is exactly what you said, Hayom. This is what it says.
Got me, yeah.
So the day.
I mean, Christopher Reeve, I have to say, Christopher Reeve is one of the most phenomenal human beings on the planet. There's absolutely no question. And, you know, Superman, yeah. You know, and, you know, if this wouldn't have happened to him, you know, he would have, you know, a nice Hollywood actor, etc. I mean, mean, talk about, you know, self-transformation and growing from adversity and you know, taking your life and making a mission out of it. I mean, it's really, you know. I think the Jewish school should try to invite him. I don't know what he charges, but he is the person who exemplifies really all that, a lot of things that we've been talking about in the Book of Iyov and how one grows from adversity. And, you know, yeah. Every day. There's another little point that is made in this story, a little Hasidic story, which is very interesting, which focuses on the first word, re'eh, the concept of looking. Meaning, it's not enough that God gives us blessings in life, but you need the blessing to see the blessing. There's a re'eh here. They tell a little story about a great Rebbe who very much yearned to go to the land of Israel. So whenever someone came from Israel, he would always ask the person, describe it to me, tell it to me, I want to hear. So a person once came, a beggar, and the beggar came from the land of Israel, and he told the Rebbe, you have to go because the dirt is diamonds. You look at the dirt and the dust and they're diamonds. So the Rebbe said, well, doesn't sound quite right. The Rebbe eventually went to Israel, and he had a wonderful experience. And when he came back, he met that same beggar. And the beggar said, "Nu, what did you see? How did you like it?" So the Rebbe said, in kind of a jocular way, "It was everything you said, but you know, I mean, the dirt wasn't diamonds." He said it kind of as a joke, "I didn't see diamonds." So the beggar turned dead serious and said, "Well, you didn't look hard enough." So the Rebbe was taken aback because he said it as a joke. But he sees now that on some level there was something serious that was being said here. And perhaps this was Eliyahu HaNavi in disguise, you know, who sometimes comes in the guise of the beggar. So the Rebbe prayed and fasted and did all sorts of things. And then one day he walked out on the street and he saw, yeah, you know, I do see the diamonds. The diamonds are in fact there. And the story again illustrates the concept that in life there are many, many diamonds. But the problem is not that God doesn't make the blessings available. The problem is our eyes don't see them. And sometimes the greatest blessing that God can give us, which we have to try to earn also, is that we can see the blessing that is there. This is brought out actually very graphically in the story of Hagar, which we read on Rosh Hashanah, when she looks for water for her son Yishmael. So the verse says, "And God opened her eyes, and she saw the well." It doesn't say God made a well. God opened her eyes. Meaning, the well, in some way we don't fully understand, the well was there. She did not see it. And the blessing was to have your eyes opened. That is the notion of re'eh, you know, because so much of our life, we discussed this in the Aseret Dibrot, dealing with jealousy, not coveting. So much of one's life is spent in wanting what we don't have and not necessarily looking at the blessings that we do have, whatever they might be. And that is also the re'eh, that one has to look and see the blessing that God has given. Moshe here then goes on and introduces a ritual. And here the ritual is a bit confusing because he's introducing a ritual that is not to be performed in his lifetime, but a ritual that is to be performed after the Jews cross the Jordan. Remember where they are? They are now situated east of the Jordan River. Now, let's think about this for a second, because you might be thinking, gee, if any of you have good math minds, think about where Egypt is. Egypt is southwest of Israel. Southwest. Now, if you go from Egypt to Israel, you would normally go up the Mediterranean coast. How do you find yourself on the east bank of the Jordan, you know, where Jordan is today? Right? How do you get there? Well, remember, the Torah itself says in Exodus, after they left Egypt, God did not lead them up to the Mediterranean coast because they would have encountered the Philistines. And so soon after they left Egypt, any encounter with the Philistines would have driven them back to Egypt. And therefore, God took them south. They crossed the Red Sea, which is probably the Gulf of Aqaba. It was not the whole Red Sea. And then they continued southward and they actually went around the Dead Sea. Okay, that's how they wound up in the East Bank. They went, they crossed the Gulf of Aqaba, they proceeded south along the Sinai, and then they eventually encircled the Dead Sea. Then they moved north, right, the Jordan River runs into the Dead Sea, till they find themselves on the east bank of the Jordan, opposite happens to be Jericho. Jericho is a little bit north of Yerushalayim, okay? So that's how they got all the way around, because God did not want them to encounter the Philistines, because at that early stage in the Exodus, they would have lost faith. I mean, they had a lot of problems anyway, and they would have returned to Egypt. So anyway, so the ritual that Moshe Rabbeinu states here is the following. When you cross the Jordan, which will not be in his lifetime, when you cross the Jordan and you find yourself on the west bank, there will be two mountains. There will be Mount Gerizim, Har Gerizim, and Mount Eval. And in fact, these two mountains are right near Shechem, again, north of Jericho. And six tribes should stand on Mount Gerizim, half of the people. Six tribes should stand on Mount Eval. The Leviim and the Kohanim should be in the middle with a Sefer Torah. I'm sorry, with the Aron HaKodesh, with the Ark. And blessings should be pronounced as they are facing Mount Gerizim, and curses should be pronounced as they are facing Har Eval. And the blessing, now here, let me just explain something. The ritual here is described in a very fragmented way. It simply says, the blessing shall be placed on Mount Gerizim, the curse shall be placed on Mount Eval. But it doesn't give us any details. But if you look at the end of the book of Devarim, the details are fleshed out much more. Let me show you the expanded narrative. The expanded narrative is in chapter 27. Starting from verse 11. Okay, so you should connect the beginning of Parshat Triyeh with the narrative as it is described in chapter 27, where it says, Vayitzav Moshe et ha'am v'yomahu leimor. Moshe commanded the people that day, Eile yamdu levarech et ha'am al ha-gerizim. The following tribes shall stand on Mount Gerizim for the bracha. And it mentions, now again, this is a very peculiar list. It doesn't seem to have any particular reason. I'll discuss that in a moment. Shimon v'Levi v'Yehuda, Yisachar, Yosef v'Binyamin. Well, it starts off somewhat chronological, but it leaves out Reuven. Okay, so it says Shimon, Levi, Yehuda, Yisachar. These are the four children of the six of Leah. Leah had six boys. She also had Reuven and Zebulun, but they're taken out. Yosef and Binyamin are the two children of Rachel. And then on the Klala, they stand in Har Eval, Reuven, Gad, Asher, Zebulun, Dan, v'Naphtali. So six tribes are in one mountain, six tribes are the other mountain. Then it mentions Leviim are in the middle. Now you might say there's already a contradiction. What do you mean the Leviim are standing in the middle? Didn't the Pasuk just say that Levi was one of the tribes that stood on the mountain? The answer is that Levi was divided. There were Leviim on the mountain, but then there were Leviim who were in the middle. And the way it worked was, the Leviim would look at the cursed mountain, and they would pronounce a curse. For example, the curses are, cursed is the man who makes an idol, and everybody would say, Amen. Cursed is the man who humiliates his father and mother, and the people would say, Amen. Cursed is the one who infringes the boundary of someone else's property. Cursed is the one who misleads the blind and helpless. Cursed is the one who perverts the judgment of the widow or the orphan. Cursed is the one that commits incest with various relatives or even with animals, etc. Now, the way it works, if you read these things, you only see the curses. But the rabbinic tradition says each curse was preceded by a blessing in the opposite way. So you don't get the whole picture here. The way it worked was, first the Leviim would look at the mountain of Gerizim, And they would say, blessed is the person who does not make an idol and turn away from God. And everybody would say, amen. Then they would turn and say, cursed is the person. So the Torah only gives you here half of the story, perhaps to frighten us a bit more. But in fact, every arur, every curse, was coupled with a blessing. Now, this was supposed to be a covenantal experience, meaning to say, just like Mount Sinai was the great covenant with God, so too there's a covenant that was entered into shortly after we entered the land of Israel. And if you look in the book of Yehoshua, the book of Joshua, you will actually see the record of this being done. In other words, in the Chumash, it was not done yet. It was done after the Jews crossed the Jordan, but it is simply described. And in fact, to this very day, you know, Mount Gerizim is a well-known mountain. Mount Gerizim, the Samaritans actually sacrificed the Paschal Lamb on Mount Gerizim. It's actually a holy place for them, and they actually bring sacrifices and the like. But Har Gerizim, to this very day, is a very fertile mountain, and Mount Eval, which is right next to it, is a very desolate hill. And it is said that that is a result of the fact that Har Eval was the mountain of the curse, and Har Gerizim was the mountain of the blessing. What seems to bother us, though, a little bit is, gee, you put six tribes on the cursed mountain and six tribes on the blessed mountain. It's almost as if, you know, those six tribes are getting cursed. If you're going to have it that way, wouldn't it make sense, I guess, that each tribe, half should be on one mountain, half should be on the other? Even then, you have the stigma of individuals who are assigned to the cursed mountain. Well, I once saw, there's no real good explanation of why those six are there and those six were there. But I once saw a computer study, very interesting computer study, which, you know, it is recorded in the book of Numbers how many people of each tribe, how many people each tribe had at this time. So if you wanted to have a situation of an equal number of people, this is really the closest combination you could get. In other words, any possible combination of six tribes and six tribes would not yield an equivalent number, because different tribes are different sizes. In other words, of all the combinations, how many combinations are there? If you have 12 tribes, how many combinations of two groups of six could you make? There are many, many permutations, as it were, but none of the permutations would achieve a perfect balance. And it could very well be that God wanted to show what the rabbis of the Talmud said much later, that each person must regard the world as being equally balanced in goodness and in evil. And anything we do can make the difference. We can shift the balance in one direction or the other. So the concept is the scale. The cursed mountain is equally balanced with the blessed mountain. And therefore, the goodness that we do tips the scale in the direction of goodness. The evil that we do tips the scale in the direction of evil. Suffice it to say, though, that this narrative was never understood as somehow a condemnation of those specific six. I mean, they were chosen symbolically to represent this balance of good and evil. Right? You have a play, right? Somebody has to play. You know, if you have a play, let's assume you have a dramatic rendition of the book of Job, right? So somebody has to play the Satan. You know, it's the role that one is assigned, but it is not necessarily a symbol of condemnation. So this is the ritual that is referred to. So in Parashat Re'eh, it's very fragmentary. It simply says, when you come to Israel, you shall place the blessing towards Mount Gerizim and place the curse towards Mount Eval, and that is described, as I said, in chapter 27. Okay. That takes us now to chapter 12. Now, chapter 12, Moshe Rabbeinu now shifts gears, and now he begins the discussion of halakha, the various mitzvot that are incumbent on the people once they come to the land of Israel. And here we will not go through verse by verse by verse, but I just want to kind of summarize the basic issues. One of Moshe's primary concerns is that the idolatrous relics of Canaanite worship be utterly destroyed. There is a command to uproot and destroy Avodah Zarah, the objects of paganism, the objects of worship, simply because there is a fear that if the temples and the idols be allowed to remain, the Jewish people might become attracted to them and might forsake God. So the first mitzvah is Abed Ta'abdun, you shall utterly destroy. As you know, in Biblical Hebrew, the repetition of a verb, Abed, like Aveda is a lost object, destroy. The repetition of a verb connotes emphasis, emphatic. You shall, I think the English even says, you shall surely destroy. That probably is how the translation commonly goes. You shall surely or utterly destroy. Kol hamakomot, all of the places asher avdu sham agoyim, that those nations worship, asher atem yorshim otam, that you are inheriting their land, et Eloheihem, with their idols, destroy the places and the idols, whether they are on the mountains or the hills or the trees, and you shall eradicate them. Now then, look at verse 4. Verse 4 is a strange verse. So after it says, you shall utterly destroy all traces of idolatrous worship. By the way, we're not discussing here killing people. We'll get to that later. But this is not talking about killing any human being right now. This is a mitzvah regarding the physical destruction of idolatrous objects. You know, this of course raises a lot of issues. Is there any paganism or is there any idolatry that is practiced in Israel today? Now, we understand that the concept of Avodah Zarah, idolatry, does have symbolic meanings that go beyond the technical. For example, the concept of Avodah Zarah can exist whenever you worship anything instead of God. So if you worship money, if you worship career, if you worship power, in a symbolic sense, that is Avodah Zarah. There's no question. And when God says, you shall eradicate it, it also refers to that. And the symbolic meaning is legitimate. However, symbolic meanings can coexist with technical legal meanings. The legal meaning here is it refers to the practice of pagan idolatry. Right? So it doesn't say destroy banks. It says destroy Avodah Zarah. So the question then becomes, well, what is Avodah Zarah? And it's a very complicated issue. Is Christianity Avodah Zarah? Now, we discussed, I think very, very briefly, that Maimonides writes in a part of the Mishneh Torah that is censored, it is not in our Mishneh Torah, that he felt that Christianity, of course the only version he knew of was Catholicism, there was no Reformation yet, Christianity was idolatry because it ascribed to God a material form in the form of Jesus. Although that was not the original teaching of Christianity. I mean, the original teaching was Jesus was a Messiah. Jesus was not elevated to the realm of a divinity till hundreds of years later, but that was already the teaching when Maimonides lived. So he wrote that although Maimonides did not have kind words for Mohammed, in the other class I'm giving, we read about letters in which Mohammed is constantly referred to as that nuts, that mishuga. But nevertheless, Maimonides writes that Islam is a monotheistic religion and Islam is not idolatry. And Christianity, he felt, was idolatry because it placed a material form in God. Others disagreed, other great rabbis disagreed, and they said Christianity is not Jewish. A Jew cannot be a Christian, but Christianity is not idolatry. See, that's very important because you see, under the seven commandments of Noah, non-Jews are not supposed to be involved in idolatry either. So even though a Jew cannot be a Christian, that's obvious, but a Christian can be a Christian according to this because it is not Avodah Zarah. Now, a full understanding would of course depend on going through all of the hundreds of denominations. For example, Unitarianism is in all probability a monotheistic religion. The Unitarian Christian belief rejects the concept of Trinity and believes in the incorporeal God. What is the story? When Louis Brandeis, the first Jewish Supreme Court justice, was once visiting Oliver Wendell Holmes, who was another very great Supreme Court justice, older than Brandeis. He was sitting with Mrs. Holmes. Now, Holmes was an old Boston Brahmin family. And in fact, his father, Oliver Wendell Holmes Sr., was that famous writer, wrote Old Ironsides and everything else. But his son, among the legal community, the son is more known than the father. Among the general community, the father might be more known than the son. So Holmes is an old Boston Brahmin, so Mrs. Holmes is sitting with this Jewish guy, Louis Brandeis, you know, and says, what church do you belong to? It says, Brandeis says, well, I'm Jewish, I belong to the Jewish church. So Mrs. Holmes said, oh, well, we're Unitarians. So do you know what that is? So Brandeis said, no. So she said, well, in Boston, you got to be something, and this is the least you can get away with. So you have to belong to a church, and So Unitarian is kind of a very vague type of religion in which, like ethical culture with a belief in God, so you can do what you want. But I just saw a very interesting article about the Dalai Lama. Now, apparently, the Dalai Lama, who's very beloved by everybody, he goes to the Holocaust Museum. In fact, he likes Jews a lot. Jews get together with him, the Jew and the Lotus is about Jewish encounters with the Dalai Lama. But the Dalai Lama was recently picketed here in the United States by his fellow Tibetans. Why? Because he was accused of being religiously intolerant. Because apparently, as part of the Tibet Buddhism, which he is the leader of, there is still a belief in various spirits and idols and the like, and he has been trying to discourage that. He said that he used to worship it, but he's become convinced that these are evil spirits, etc. So apparently there is a debate regarding the concept of Avodah Zarah within Tibetan Buddhism, and some of the old liners feel that this abandonment of statues and spirits is actually a reform, as it were, of the Orthodox version of Tibetism. So, he's undergoing that type of issue. So, the Eastern religions in particular are very, very tricky. Now, many of Buddhists will tell you, well, we're not idolatrous at all. On the other hand, here you see the Dalai Lama is actually not accusing, but he's asserting that the Dalai Lama himself is saying that some of the forms of Tibetan worship border on idolatry, which are inconsistent with the belief in a supreme God. So, one question which has not been really satisfactorily answered is that Christianity is discussed. Islam is actually monotheistic, so there's no problem with mosques in the land of Israel, although we're not very happy about where some of those mosques are. But there are Eastern religions in Israel. The Baha'i Temple is the largest in the world. It's in Haifa. And the question is, you read these verses, I don't have a good answer to this. You read these verses in which the Torah says it is prohibited to allow idolatry to exist in the land of Israel. So Israel's not a purely halakhic state. There are certain things we can't do. But the question is, in an ideal situation, would there be an obligation to, as it were, either physically eradicate or at least order these things to be removed? I don't have a clear answer. Is there some indication that these mitzvot only applied when there was a temple? It doesn't seem from the text. These seem to be absolute notions that the land of Israel should be free from the idolatry. So something to think about. Sometimes you read these mitzvot and you ask yourself, well, were these mitzvot meant to be carried out today? And how would they be carried out today? And I really don't know. I have not found any particular guidance, but there is certainly a theological issue. What is Avodah Zarah? Now, a narrow interpretation might be that this is understood as pertaining only to the seven ancestral nations, the Canaanites, the Amorites, in other words, those nations which were particularly evil, in which you have to eradicate, and perhaps it wouldn't automatically translate into other forms of worship by other people, but the matter still would need to be investigated.
Just as an aside, Harry Golden, the famous Jewish author, called Unitarianism Junitarian.
Junitarian. Okay. Well,
because of so many Jews.
That's right.
In the 30s.
That's an excellent point. When Jews had a lot of pressure in order to get into the country club, you had to convert, you had to go to church. So they were looking for a church which would be least different than Judaism, and Unitarianism was in fact the choice of many assimilated Jews, precisely for that reason, kind of a country club for Christianity, in a sense. Okay, but then we look at verse 4, which is a little bit shocking. Verse 1 to 3 say, utterly destroy idolatry. And then it says, and don't do it to God. Well, what exactly is this saying? Do not do what I just told you to do to them, don't do it to me. So the question becomes, Rashi raises the question, do the Jews need to be told, you know, not to destroy the objects of God's worship? So Rashi offers a very good explanation. Rashi says that this is the source of the law that God's name is not supposed to be erased. That there is indeed a halakha. In other words, one of the prohibitions of the Torah is called mechikat Hashem. One is not allowed to erase or destroy or deface God's name. That is why, for example, many people have a tradition that they don't spell out God's name, right? They write G-D. The basis of that is because if letters or papers get thrown into the garbage or whatever it is, God's name is being desecrated, so you don't write it out in full. That is why in Hebrew even, unless it's a siddur, you write, you know, a hey or a dalet, you don't spell out God's name. In fact, there are all sorts of problems. Sometimes there are newspaper advertisements, let's say around Hanukkah time, that may reprint the blessings over the Hanukkah candles, so people will know what to do in December, right? Because they kind of compete with the other things that are going on. And sometimes they will print on the newspaper God's name. As Baruch Atah, it'll say the Yud, two Yuds, or Yud Hey Vav Hey, whatever. And there are going to be all sorts of laws regarding throwing it away. That's why we have what is called a genizah, or colloquially it's called Shemus, which is just the Yiddish for Shemot. Shemot means the names of God, in which when you collect worn sidurim or chumashim or sheets that have blessings or words of Torah on them, you're not supposed to throw them in the garbage, but you put them in specially designated repositories. In fact, the famous Cairo Geniza, which was the source of so many discoveries, was essentially, you know, 1,000 years of accumulated Shemos that people were bringing. Now, where do you get the concept? The Sefer Torah, for example, is put in Shemos. The concept is from this. After God says, destroy and wreck all of the idolatry, God says, when it comes to holy things, you cannot do that. In other words, this is the source of the whole concept of Shemos, of Genizah, and the like. Now, Genizah, if you're committed to this halacha, is an awfully, awfully tough issue, because the reason is the amounts of paper that we have to get rid of today is just phenomenally high. You know, with Xeroxing and everything else, you know, all the classroom stuff, the newspapers, right? You have, let's say, the Jewish Week. So the Jewish Week has a Devar Torah column. So does that mean I got to save, you know, all the Jewish weeks, or do I have to cut out the Torah column and put that in Genizah? Etc. And what do you do with all sorts of sheets and everything else and all of these little things that fundraising organizations send you, which have different blessings on them, right? What do you do with all this stuff, right? Just a tremendous amount of stuff. So the truth of the matter is, if one wants to be extra strict, it is indeed proper to put any religious teachings in a genizah, but there are also dispensations to kind of separate it. You have to differentiate between two types of holy things. Holy literature that actually has God's name, particularly if it's in Hebrew, God's name, must be put in Genizah. You must find a Genizah and put it there. Other things like Torah, you know, Torah thoughts and the like, can be separated in paper recycling, meaning it shouldn't be thrown with the food. It shouldn't be thrown in a denigrating or disrespectful place. But you can either wrap it in plastic or put it with paper recycling, in which case it is kept away from the garbage. But if it's actually God's name, then it wouldn't be proper. That really should be separated. So again, it's something to be aware of, but all I'm saying is that this very large edifice of law is derived from this little verse, thou shalt not do what you do to them, thou shalt not do to God. And this even raises other issues. What about tapes? For example, let's assume that you have a videotape of a wedding. And on the videotape, God's name was recited in a blessing. Can you erase the tape? Or an audio, same thing with an audio tape, right? Is that called mechikat Hashem? Right? These are all issues that are discussed. And then the question becomes, this I think we'd be leaning it on, a computer screen. You get something off the internet, a bracha. The bracha has God's name. Well, can you shut off your computer? Can you switch the page? Are you bound to keep your computer on forever and ever? Because to shut off the computer would be erasing God's name. So on that already, you're allowed to shut off your computer. But these are issues that are discussed because this concept of God's name is so holy. Now, having said that, there is one place in the Torah where not only are you allowed to erase and destroy God's name, but it's a mitzvah to erase and destroy God's name. And that is, that's right. And that is not in the book of Devarim, but in the book of Numbers, Bamidbar. We read about the ritual of the woman that is suspected of adultery. And if you remember, there is a ritual that she is brought to the temple. And psukim, verses about the sin of adultery, are written on a piece of parchment which contained God's name. And the verses are dissolved in water. And she drinks the water with the verses dissolved in it. And the concept is, if she's guilty of adultery, she dies. And if she's not guilty of adultery, she's blessed and has children, etc. The Ramban says this is the only mitzvah of the Torah that is predicated on an open miracle. I mean, this was a miracle that happened. And the Talmud says that it stopped working when the men were unfaithful too. Because it only works when the husbands were faithful and the wives were not. When everybody is unfaithful to each other, which was the case at various times, the ritual didn't work. By the way, the Talmud also says that miraculously, simultaneously when the woman died, whoever she was with, the guy that she was with could be 100 miles away, he would drop dead at the same moment. It kind of, it should be chapter 7, chapter 6 or chapter 7. Do you have a chumash there? You could, you could check. But the thing is this, in preparing this special water, it's called the cursed waters, the bitter waters, God's name is erased. God's name is dissolved. How could that be so? So the Talmud says that God says, better that my name be erased and destroyed in order to make peace and reconciliation, if she's innocent, between a husband and a wife. That for Shalom Bayit, Hashem says, let even my name be destroyed. So it just shows you once again how important the concept of Shalom Bayit is. Which again, everything, every question gives rise to a lot of other questions, because that text may be very relevant on a very difficult issue that often exists, and that is we often have situations where a married couple are not at the same point in their religious observances. One is further along, one is more committed than the other. There might be issues of one keeps kosher, the other is not so strict in kosher. One keeps the Shabbat, the other is not so strict in keeping Shabbat. Those are by and large navigable. Those are not really the most difficult conflicts, because listen, I can live with somebody who doesn't keep kosher. I keep kosher, they don't keep kosher. As long as we respect each other, and as long as the one that doesn't keep kosher acknowledges my right to keep kosher, that's a possible way of living, although it's not the most comfortable way of living. Where things are extraordinarily difficult is the area of Taharat HaMishpacha, the family purity laws, where one wants to keep it and one doesn't, because that's a particular area of law in which you need mutual cooperation, as it were. And those are extraordinarily difficult issues. Sometimes people cite the ritual of Sota to demonstrate that God, in effect, says, my name could be erased in order to make Shalom Bayit, which suggests that there are room in certain situations for compromise and accommodation. But once again, it's a very, very delicate issue, because this was not taken in the halakhic tradition to allow for total abrogation of religious restraint. In other words, God, as it were, says you can erase my name, but God doesn't necessarily say, you could violate Shabbat and other things. But the point that it does bring out is that one should not view this as a conflict between religion and Shalom Bayit, but rather one has to regard Shalom Bayit as part of the religion as well. So it's a question of how to balance the requirements of Judaism against each other. In other words, it's not Judaism versus marriage. It is a conflict within the proper observance of Judaism, and the Shalom Bayit must be prioritized to at least to the extent of the other thing in striking that particular balance. Okay, that is one interpretation of do not do this to God. The other interpretation is it refers to a different thing, which the verse will go on to, and that is God just described a religion in which there are many, many temples serving God in different places. And here, Moshe is stressing the notion of centrality of worship, at least in Israel, that they have temples all over the place, but you shall not worship God that way. You shall worship God with a centralized sanctuary. See, that's what verse 5 says. In other words, according to this, you read verse 4 and 5 together. Do not do this to God, but only to the place that God shall choose to rest his name there. There you shall go. Which means this is a reference, of course, to the concept of a temple that is to be built in Jerusalem. Now note, Moshe does not say Jerusalem. Look how he describes the temple. The makom, you shall go to the place. Asher yivchar Hashem Elokeichem, that God, your God, will choose mikol shifteichem, from amongst your tribes, losum et shemo sham, to place his name there, l'shichno tidrishu, to his dwelling place. Shichno and mishkan are the same word. Shachen is a neighbor. To his dwelling place, sidrishu, you shall seek. Midrash is to investigate, to seek. You shall seek. Uvata shama, and you shall go there.
Okay. Yeah. Question. Yeah. Since God knew in advance where the temple was going to be established, why is he secretive about this? Why does he say, when you get into Eretz Yisrael and you capture the city of Jerusalem, you will build a temple there?
Well, the reason is actually very clear. Because keep in mind that the temple in Jerusalem was not built until 480 years after the Jews left Egypt. How do I know this? This is a verse in the Book of Kings. When King Solomon built the temple, it said it was built 480 years after they left Egypt. Now, let's work a little backwards. So how many years were they in the land of Israel before they had a temple? Well, they wandered in the desert 40 years. So if it's 480 from Yetziat Mitzrayim, they were in Israel 440 years until King Solomon built the temple. Meaning, those 440 years, that was the period of Joshua, the period of the judges, the period of King David. Remember, King David wanted to build the temple, and God did not allow him to do it. So where was the sanctuary for the 440 years that they were in Israel? So it was in several places. It was in Shiloh for a while. It was in Nob, the city of the Kohanim, that Shaul murdered because they gave shelter to King David. It was in Gibeon. So God deliberately did not say Jerusalem. He said, the place that I chose, because this is in recognition that there were multiple places until the final resting place in Jerusalem. So that's why he leaves it open. But it is important to know, though, that one of the names of Jerusalem, again, you see certain names here. It's the Makom Asher Yivchar Hashem. It is the place that God will choose. It is Shichno. It is his dwelling place. Right, these are the names of Yerushalayim, but the truth is, it's oblique because it also encompasses Shiloh and the like. And this essentially establishes the halakha that the korbanot are only allowed to be brought in the centralized sanctuary. They cannot be brought elsewhere. Now, one can raise the interesting question, was there an institution of a synagogue that coexisted with the temple. In other words, when you had a temple, there was a sacrificial rite that was brought. So let's say I lived in Tel Aviv, right? I wasn't in Jerusalem. Well, there was no Tel Aviv then, but I lived in Yafo, right? Yafo is very old. Yafo existed in the Bible times, biblical times. Yonah, the prophet Yonah, took a boat from Yafo, right, to escape God. So what did I do on Shabbat? Did I sleep late? In other words, was life like much easier when there was a temple? You know, you didn't go to shul, you didn't have to do anything. Yom Kippur, you know, you had to fast. But you know, everything happened in the Beit HaMikdash. So if you weren't there, what did you do? So it's hard to imagine that Jews did not have houses of prayer, even when there was a temple. So certainly this concept of there being a centralized sanctuary was not meant to preempt the notion of minyan and coming together and praying to God. Prayer is not linked to prayer is not limited to Jerusalem. Prayer is something that's available everywhere. But the Torah is emphasizing that the sacrificial rite is tied to a specific place. And the reason that's very important is because if each person builds his own altar, then it degenerates very easily to the type of paganistic, ritualistic worship. Then it becomes Avodah Zarah, right? So those are called bamot. Bamot are the individual altars that people erect in their homes or their local temples. Their bamot, but that's considered sinful by virtue of these verses, that one does not erect a bama, a high place for themselves. One must go to the Beit HaMikdash. Now, if you think about the roles of the Beit HaMikdash, the sanctuary, keep in mind that korbanot were brought every single day. Remember, there was a daily ritual, a morning korban, an afternoon korban. And if individuals wanted to bring offerings for sin or whatever, they would bring their korbanot as well. But there were three times a year in which all of the Jewish people were expected to show up to Jerusalem. And these are, of course, the three regalim, Pesach, Shavuot, Sukkot, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, and not regalim. People stayed at home for those. But Pesach, Shavuot, Sukkot. And just think about the effect of having millions and millions of people coming in the sense of giving one a sense of belonging to a nation. You see, the Beit HaMikdash served not only as a religious center, but it also served as a center of national identification. And that is one of the functions of the Beit HaMikdash, to give the tribes a sense of being a single nation. And that was an extraordinarily important point. And part of why God is condemning the proliferation of individual bamot is that it would deprive the people of that experience of centrality, which was so essential. So the Beit HaMikdash is an extraordinarily important national institution as well as a religious institution. we obviously don't have that equivalent today, but Yerushalayim as a city, you know, serves somewhat of that same same purpose. Okay. Another interesting point is that for the first time, they were allowed to eat meat. Let me explain a little bit of the background of meat eating in this situation. Again, there are people who are vegetarian and sometimes out of religious and moral principles, sometimes out of health. Let me give you a little bit of the halachic history of vegetarianism. It's very clear from the Talmud's understanding that from the time of Adam, from the time of Adam, till the flood of Noah, human beings were not permitted to eat animal life. Adam HaRishon lived on a plant diet, and eating animals was not permitted. Animals could be given as sacrifices to God. That's what Hevel did. Hevel brought his sheep to God, but you could not eat it. After the flood, however, God tells Noah that you and your children are now allowed to eat animal flesh. You're allowed to. Now, why did things change before and after? Well, Nachmanides suggests that it really was a physical situation, that as a result of the climactic changes because of the floods, weather became harsher, conditions became more difficult, and therefore human beings needed the extra nutrients they could get from a meat diet. Now, from that day on, from that time on, clearly vegetarianism is not required as a matter of Jewish law. The question then becomes, is it desirable? In other words, is it morally desirable? And that is where you do have a legitimate debate within the Jewish tradition. Some look to the fact that in man's ideal state, not to take animal life, it was only a concession to what was perceived to as a need. So if one can structure a diet which doesn't have to do that, perhaps it would be ideal, because after all, so much of kashrut is predicated on reverence for life, right? We slaughter the animal in a way that is supposed to not be painful. We don't drink the blood, because the blood is life, and we have a certain reverence for that life. So the argument goes, even if God allows us to eat meat subject to all of these regulations, so certainly anyone that says the Torah prohibits consumption of meat would obviously be wrong, there's no question, but still, wouldn't it be taking kashrut one step further by saying, my reverence for life will be such that I will not take life for my human consumption? So some take that position, and that might be defensible. Others say, well, if God said it's okay, then who are we to say it's not okay? The Kabbalists even go further. The Kabbalists have the idea that the animal soul, right, we have different souls. We have the soul of the inanimate, the soul of the vegetative, the soul of the animal, the human soul, the Jewish soul, different levels of souls. And the animal soul very much desires to become elevated and sanctified. And the situation is, you are actually liberating the animal soul by incorporating it into your body, which then gets elevated. In other words, the animal wants to be slaughtered, as it were, to be eaten. Of course, you could ask the animal, but I'm not sure. But to be eaten and incorporated into the human neshama, particularly when the consumption of meat is linked to mitzvot, such as recitation of brachot before you eat, the mitzvah of Shabbat, right, these different things. So the Kabbalists would say, not only is vegetarianism not appropriate, but indeed you're hurting the animal by rejecting it from that type of elevation. So Kabbalistically, there's an argument in favor of meat. I will say this, you know, whether one says vegetarianism is morally proper, or whether one says that the Torah says it's okay to eat meat, so it's okay to eat meat, the one thing that is absolutely clear is it's absolutely prohibited to abuse or inflict pain on animals. So, for example, if one considers the conditions under which animals are raised, particularly veal, where the calves are penned up and not allowed to move, or the chickens are stuffed, or whatever it is, that's against halacha. And if one were to say that I'm going to boycott the eating of veal in order to discourage those types of practices, that would clearly be, in other words, one cannot say eating meat is immoral because the Torah says you're allowed to eat meat, but one can say, and perhaps one should say, that the things that are being done to the animals are immoral, and therefore I will not participate in encouraging those practices. So that's a different thing. You're not condemning the eating of meat, you're condemning the practices which are being done to the animals. Yes. Well, I don't know. I can't really defend it. I think there's a feeling that our impact would be relatively ineffectual in changing the practices, and therefore people say, let's put our efforts in issues in which we can make a difference. I think there might be a feeling that we can't make a big difference if you're talking about, although I would imagine that if it's kosher, if they're raised to be kosher animals, kosher consumers would obviously make a difference. That's right. Yeah, I actually am a little disappointed that there has not been more activism on this. Again, I want to sharply differentiate this. If somebody tells me that, you know, eating meat is immoral, I have to reject that theologically because the Torah says you can do it. But that doesn't mean that one can torture animals and inflict pain on animals and the like. That's a violation of Tzar Balei Chaim, of not inflicting pain on animals. That is one of the mitzvot of the Torah. Same thing with all sorts of animal experimentation. Now, you have to understand, you know, there are people, animal rights activists, that actually claim that for human beings to put their needs above those of the animal kingdom is a form of racism. It's called speciesism, in which, you know, who gives you the right to say you're better than that dog? Now, in that sense, the Torah rejects the concept that animals and humans are the same. We are given domination and control over the animal kingdom. However, it's a domination and control that has to have a sense of what the Christians call stewardship. It's an old Christian term, but, you know, it makes sense, meaning it's a sense of control and domination, but a sense of responsibility and compassion. So, what would we say, for example, regarding animal dissection, animal experimentation? You know, if the only way we could obtain information about a cancer drug that might save human lives is by doing things on animals, and there's no other alternative, Halakha would say, very regretfully and with a great deal of sadness, we do what we need to do to save human lives. If, on the other hand, you're talking about testing a deodorant or testing a perfume, and that involves blinding animals, Halakha would say no, because the benefit for mankind does not justify that type of pain. So Halakha does not say animals and humans are the same. But Halakha says that pain on the animals must be justified only if it will produce a benefit for humanity that is more important than the pain that the animal is suffering. So cancer drugs, yes. Cosmetics, no. You know, so it would be that type of situation. I think that there certainly is a very, very strong basis to protest the inhumane way that animals are kept.
Isn't there a concept of Ein Sin Ko Ela Basar V'Yayin?
So now we come to the special rules. Is there a special obligation to eat meat on Shabbat or Yom Tov? So it's very interesting. There actually is a difference between Shabbat and Yom Tov in the eyes of Halakha. On Shabbat, one has to have meals. One eats three meals on Shabbat, right? Suda, Shlishit, etc. But there's not really a clear obligation that it has to be meat. If one likes other food, one can eat other food. On Yom Tov, however, there are those that say, based on Talmudic teaching, that since on Yom Tov special korbanot were brought that were eaten, therefore to commemorate that, there's a mitzvah of basar, of eating some meat on Yom Tov. Even then the question becomes, well, does fish count as meat? Some say, you know, fish might be treated as meat. Because the truth of the matter is, a lot of people eat chicken, but you know, if you have to imitate the korbanot that were brought in the temple, it would have to be beef, right? Because chicken was not brought as a korban. In fact, it's very fascinating. I always was wondering, just to digress for a moment, that given the difference in price between beef and chicken, beef is much more expensive. So you have a lot of religious people who may eat meat during the week, but on Shabbat they make a point of chicken or something. It is like, why chicken? Chicken is cheaper. But it's interesting that you have to remember that until post-World War II, Frank Perdue, the mass production of chicken, in Eastern Europe, chicken was a lot more expensive. We don't remember that. It was more expensive than beef. The mass production of chicken is post-World War II phenomenon. It was not that way. Chicken was like pheasant. It was expensive. It was hard to get. So that's why the tradition became in many homes that chicken was the holiday meal, even though today it frankly doesn't make a lot of sense. One would assume that for Yom Tov you give the more expensive rather than the less expensive. That's a little bit of historic trivia.
But in Europe, yeah, in these villages, every Jewish family had some chickens in the backyard.
Well, apparently not. At least in the cities, that wasn't the case. Maybe in the little villages. In the cities where you had to buy chicken, chicken was actually more expensive per pound than beef. Just like today, kosher cheese, I think, is more expensive. So you might as well have dairy meals for that.
It's also possible that
we're
eating meat even then, because maybe they were eating eggs and fish. And
maybe they kept it. They kept
and
it for egg production. You're destroying your productive investment.
Right.
That could be. They had the chicken, but you didn't kill it.
Wasn't chicken though?
Yeah, under biblical law, a chicken is not is parv, meaning to say you're allowed to have chicken and milk together. Because the verse in the Bible which prohibits meat and milk says do not cook a goat or a kid in its mother's milk, meaning it's only milk-producing animals in which these laws apply, mammals. By Talmudic enactment, however, since it was easily confused with meat, so they extended it to fowl, to chicken, not to fish, but to birds, whether it be chicken or pheasant or whatever. But that's only rabbinic. It's not a Torah. It's not a Torah law in and of itself.
Well, what about Seir Izim? They also had goats and lambs that were sacrificed in those days. Does that mean on our holidays we should eat goats and lambs in addition
to
beef?
Well, you don't have to eat every kind of offering they brought, but you know, you have to eat, you know, of the type of offering that they brought, you know, a representative sample. But as they say, so the case, halakha case, we're eating some meat on Yom Tov is fairly strong, but even then, some say that if you don't like the meat, as it were, if you don't like meat, the whole point is to rejoice, you know, eating, you eat what you rejoice with. Which means, it's an interesting point, if one is a vegetarian because they don't like meat, one could say they're totally excused, even on Yom Tov, from the eating of meat. But if one is a vegetarian out of philosophical conviction, then it might be that on Yom Tov they have to take a bite. Just a bite. Doesn't have to be a lot. A little bit of sliver. And so it's ironic. In other words, the one who has a principled objection, according to halakha, may have to overcome that objection when it comes to the Yom Tov meal. But again, just a little bit. So it doesn't have to be a whole lot.
What if it's a dietary preference? You don't want to raise your cholesterol or something.
No, I understand.
Like
so I would say that one should have a bite or a sliver. In other words, unless there's a real, very, very life-threatening condition, obviously. If it's a matter of health, one can have a tiny bit. You know, it doesn't have to be a lot. One has a little bit. Now, in fact, one has to remember that certainly in Talmudic times, which talked about eating meat on Shabbat and Yom Tov, people were not having steak every day. I mean, it was likely that they were living a 98% vegetarian diet with a little bit of sliver of something on Shabbat. That is what meat consumption meant. It did not mean the meat consumption of, you know, two meals a day of having meat. And, you know, that already is a very serious health problem that one should be concerned with. Okay. Oh yeah, but I want to go on to the mention of meat here. Now, what's interesting is this though. For the 40 years of the desert, they were only allowed to eat meat if they brought a korban, meaning meat had to be linked to sacrificial worship. Meaning, if you woke up one day and you said, gee, I really want a hamburger, you had to get yourself a calf, bring it as a korban to the tabernacle, and then, you know, the blood is sprinkled on the altar, and the internal organs are sacrificed on the altar, and then you can eat the meat. In other words, meat was linked up with sacrifice. The problem is, though, once they come to Israel, and they're going to be scattered all over the country, and they can only bring a korban in one central place, at that point, it is no longer practical to limit meat consumption to the commission of a sacrificial rite, because if you live up there in Haifa, you know, it'll be hard to travel 100 miles in order to bring a korban. So, in effect, God gives us the green light for meat consumption not connected to sacrificial rites. This is called, in the language of the Talmud, this is called basar ta'ava. Basar ta'ava means, literally it means, meat of lust. That means meat that you want to eat that's not connected to korban. So the idea is that in the midbar, eating basar ta'ava was prohibited because it had to be linked, because that was very easy. The Mishkan is right there. In Eretz Yisrael, basar ta'ava is permitted. Now again, we still have the debate, well, permitted, but is it morally desirable? Like, that's the issue people discuss. But at least it is permitted. We have a green light for basar ta'ava. So that is one of the breaks that we got when we entered the land of Israel. Well, maybe there's a hint, right? I think there is a hint in the name that we'll let you do it, but don't be so proud of it either. In other words, it's not such a crowning glory, as it were.
Well, one of the complaints that the Jews had was they didn't have any meat, and so God brought this overabundance of swans or
right,
some flying birds. So
yes,
if they had animals for sacrifice,
yeah,
why were they complaining about lack of meat?
No, you're correct, but obviously we do know that they did leave Egypt with animals. If you remember, Moshe tells Paro, we are going to go with our animals, etc. But apparently, either there was a reluctance to slaughter them, except on the occasions of a korban, or not everybody had it. So in other words, those who had it were happy, and those who didn't have it were complaining. But in other words, I don't think we could assume there were no animals. There clearly were flocks that they took with them. Okay, so that is the basar ta'ava. And if you want to look at the verses there, that is in verse 20, chapter 12, verse 20, which talks about the concept of basar ta'ava. And it reiterates, however, the prohibitions of eating blood. Again, without going over all the laws of kashrut, there are many laws of basic kashrut that are mentioned here. See, in this process stage, when you just go to a kosher butcher and you get it, we don't have the same sense as they used to have of what is not kosher in an animal. There are a lot of portions in a kosher animal that are actually not kosher. Right? We're not talking about the pig, I'm talking about a cow. You shech the cow, slaughter a cow. There are many, many portions that are removed. Now, they tend to be removed either at the butcher or before it even comes to the butcher, so we don't know. But there are stuff. So let me just mention it very, very briefly. First of all, the blood is prohibited because the blood is the life force, and God says we have to have reverence for that life force. This is in contradistinction to the ancient cultures, even in Greece and Rome, which used to drink the blood of fierce animals in the belief that it would give them courage and the like. We have to refrain from that blood. Now, the way blood is removed, the ritual for removing blood, is by putting a lot of salt on the piece of meat, which draws out the blood, and then you rinse away the salt. It used to be that kosher butchers did not, this is called koshering, it's the Yiddish word koshering, making kosher, did not kosher meat, and a lot of people grew up, certainly if you came from Europe, you grew up, you know, koshering chicken, putting salt on the chicken, rinsing it away, and it's on a slanted board, so the blood runs away, and then you rinse it. Today, this is kind of a lost art. It's a little unfortunate, because one can get, almost every kosher butcher does pre-kosher the meat, so it's not something you have to do. This is why kosher meat poses a problem for people on salt-free diets, because by definition, there's a heavy residue of sodium that remains in the meat, so for those who are on low-salt diets, kosher meat should be soaked after you bring it home for an hour or so, and that kind of gets rid of the excess salt. So that's one thing that's done. I know a family, I think, that makes a point once a year. They go to a slaughtering house, they have to get a chicken that they have to actually kosher, just to keep the practice known. Other things that are removed, there are certain, we know that the gid hanasheh, the sciatic nerve, the nerve that runs through the hindquarters of cattle, is not kosher. And of course, you know why that's not kosher. That is when Yaakov was struggling with the angel, and the angel smites Yaakov on the thigh, and he's limping. And in commemoration of that encounter, the gid hanasheh is not eaten. Now, there's a different practice between the United States and Israel, and that is, the gid hanasheh is located in the hindquarters of the animal. It's very, very difficult to get out. There's a lot of scraping, it's very tightly embedded, etc. So consequently, because it costs a lot of money, the practice the Jewish communities here is that the slaughterhouses sell the entire hind quarter of cattle to non-kosher processing. And in that way, they don't have to remove the gid hanasheh. That means that in the United States, you cannot get any kosher cuts of beef that come from the hind quarters, which includes sirloin steak. It includes filet mignon, right? It excludes... Yeah. He'll give you a special order? Okay. Yeah. Okay, well, that's very good. Okay. It's a skill. It's very difficult. Now, in Israel and in Europe, where beef is scarcer, they actually go through the process of removing the gid hanasheh, and that's why you can get kosher steaks in Europe and in Israel that you would not be able generally to get in the United States. That's the gid hanasheh. Now, just to give you a little bit of symbol here, if the idea of not eating the blood is because this is our reverence to life. Our reverence to life is we don't consume the life force of another. We eat the flesh, that's kind of a concession, but we don't consume the life force. What does the gid hanasheh remind us of? So the gid hanasheh, in effect, reminds us of God's promise. Remember, Jacob's struggle with the angel is extraordinarily important because he struggles the entire night. And in the morning, he's limping. But there will be a morning. There will be a dawn. It's a reassurance to the Jews that although there'll be a galut, and there'll be a darkness, and there'll be a night, and we will be suffering from that night, we will be limping and hobbling, but there will be a day of redemption. In effect, it's an amazing thing. We tend not to ascribe... every time you walk by a sirloin steak and you don't buy it, you're making a statement in your affirmation in the belief of God's redemption. Again, I can't say that I consciously think of this every time. But, see, we normally don't look at negatives as symbolic. We look at positives. When I do something, there's something I think about. But this is a negative symbolism. When you don't do this, you're thinking about this. So that's the second thing, the gid hanasheh. Now, there is no gid hanasheh in birds, or at least the halacha does not prohibit that equivalent. So this is a problem for beef or lamb, mutton if there is. Now, the third thing that is removed is called chelev. Chelev is chet, lamed, bet, or vase. Chelev means fat. But there are two types of fats in animals. There is the kosher fat. Obviously, there's fat in the animal that is called shuman. Shuman. But then there is chelev, which is the non-kosher fat. And chelev tends to be what is called suet. Suet is kind of a soft, greasy thing. And that has to be scraped and taken away. We don't see it. That is taken care of before we get our meat. But that is removed as well. And the reason that is removed is because that was the portion of the animal that was brought on the altar. And therefore, even though the animal is not a korban, but that is considered to be God's portion in some way that we don't understand, and therefore we remove it. So these are things that are removed, even from a kosher animal, the gid hanasheh, the blood, the chalev. And these are also, it takes a very skilled butcher to know exactly what is chalev, what is shuman. It's right, like milk, right. Well, it's the same word, because milk is called milk because of its milk fat. It's fatty and oily, so it's related to that. And chalev and dam were the two portions of the animal that were brought on the altar, and therefore they are given a certain level of sanctity. It's interesting, according to Nachmanides even, blood is not prohibited because it's repulsive. Blood is prohibited because it's kind of sanctified. In other words, it represents life force. You know, it's like the opposite. It's not that, ugh, blood. It's, blood is a certain elevation, a certain holiness to blood for which we withdraw. The taboo comes from its kedushah, not from its impurity and the like. Okay, so those laws are essentially encapsulated here. Then, there's a reference to a lot of other things. Again, I just want to just translate some terms from you. Again, a lot of you are probably familiar with it, but the various types of gifts from grain and animals that are brought to the central sanctuary in Jerusalem for distribution. Let's take the typical Jewish farmer at the time of the temple. How much of his crops, as it were given away in various tithes. So keep in mind that the agricultural cycle, as the Torah envisions it, is a seven-year cycle. The seventh year being the sabbatical year in which agricultural work was not done. That's Shemitah. So in effect, the growing season is years 1 to 6. Every single year, year 1 through 6, one must give a portion of their crop to the Kohen, to a priest of their choosing. You could choose the Kohen, but you have to give a portion of your crop to the Kohen of your choosing. Remember, a Kohen did not own lands and therefore needed to be supported by the community. This portion is called Teruma. The Teruma is that which is separated. And under Torah law, you could give as little or as much as you wanted, but you have to give something. But the rabbis enacted that you should give 2%. They felt that was a reasonable measure. So if you have 100 bushels of wheat, you would give 2 of those bushels to the Kohen. Okay, that is called Truma. The next tax that is levied upon you is a 10% tax of the grain that would be given to the Levite. A 10% tax. And that is called Ma'aser. Ma'aser is 10%. Ma'aser Rishon. The first Ma'aser. You'll see why it's called the first one. By the way, the 10% is levied on the balance that is left after the Truma. So in other words, if I have 100 bushels, so 2 bushels are given to the Kohen. So now I only have 98 bushels. So my 10% is not 10% of the 100. I don't give 10 bushels to the Levi. I give 9.8 bushels to the Levi. It's a declining balance. Now, those two things existed all 6 years of the cycle. 2% to the Kohen, 10% to the Levi. Now, let me just mention that the Levi is then supposed to take 10% of the Maaser that he gets and give that to the Kohen. And that is called Trumat HaMaaser. The Truma that is separated from the Maaser. Again, it is the Kohen of his choice. So, let's figure this out. Let's assume we have only one Kohen. He gets everything. So the Kohen gets 2 bushels from me. And then he gets 0.98, almost 1 bushel, from the Levi. Because the Levi takes 10%. Of the 9.8 bushels that he got, right? The Levi got 9.8 bushels from me. He must give 10% of that to the Kohen of his choice. See, unlike my Truma, which is 2%, his Truma is 10% of the Maaser Rishon. Okay? So far we've mentioned three things. Again, these are just terms that appear in these parshiot, which might be a little unfamiliar. There is the truma that goes from me to the Kohen. There is the ma'aser rishon that goes from me to the Levi. Then there is trumat ha-ma'aser that goes from the Levi to the Kohen of his choice. Doesn't have to be the same Kohen. Okay. That occurred every year, year 1 through 6. Shemitah did not have any of these laws, because number one, you weren't supposed to grow things, but even if things grew wildly and you harvested them for your own use, you did not have to give the Trumot and the Maaser on the seventh year, because everybody could come in. I'll discuss that later. Now, there is also a second tithe, a second 10% that the Israel would have to separate. But what this second 10% was, it's called, differed from the year in the sabbatical cycle. In year 1, year 2, year 4, and year 5, year 1, year 2, year 4, and year 5, the second tithe was called Maaser Sheni, the second tithe, and that simply meant you brought 10% of your crop to Jerusalem, and you ate it together with your family as kind of a celebration. And you could choose, in fact, logically, it would be very logical that you would take your Maaser Sheni during the pilgrimage festivals, when you were going up anyway, but you could choose some other time as well. That is called Maaser Sheni. And let's assume that you were too far from Jerusalem and your food would spoil, there was no preservation. So there's an institution where you could redeem your Maaser Sheni for money, meaning to say, if I have 9.8 bushels of grain that is supposed to be the second tithe, I can separate its economic equivalent. I could separate $100 and say, the holiness of this gets transferred to this money, so the food can now be eaten here, and you take the $100 to Jerusalem, you buy food there, and you consume it. It's a way of, this is called Pidyon. Pidyon is redeeming the Maaser Sheni for money. The money is then taken and used to buy food. So this is year 1, year 2, year 4, year 5.
Why was the third year skipped?
Okay, now year 3 and year 6, the second tithe was separated, but it was not consumed in Jerusalem. It was distributed to the poor as extra charity in addition to what you give from your income. This is called Maaser Ani, the Maaser of the poor. So if you add up the total taxes here, looking at this as a tax, you see in effect that a Yisrael essentially gave around 21% of his, maybe it's unfair because the Maaser Sheni is not really a tax. The Maaser Sheni is your own consumption. But at least on year 3 and 6, the tax burden was fairly substantial, because on year 3 and 6, you gave the 2% to the Kohen as the Truma, you gave 10% to the Levi as Maaser Rishon, and then you had another 10%, which was given to the poor. That's actually 22%, but it's a little less than 22% because you're computing it on declining balances, right? It's not a straight 22%. So in a sense, in year 3 and 6, 22% of your crop was removed from your consumption. On the other years, it was really 12% because the Maaser Sheni was really for you, but you consumed it in Jerusalem. Okay? So these are what are called the matanot, the gifts that are needed. But of course you understand, this is not a tax that goes to Washington for bureaucracy. These went, number one, to the religious leadership who did not own lands and would not be able to sustain themselves. And number two, it went to the poor. And number three, the Maaser Sheni was once again a mechanism of forging your close connection to Jerusalem by going there and celebrating with the festive meal. Now, Shemitah, the sabbatical year, is very, very different. Year number 7, because one is not allowed to plant. Now the question is, how do you live during Shemitah? So it all depends. Sometimes you lived off what was harvested the preceding year. But Shemitah may have had things that had grown by themselves, like trees. The apple trees will produce. right? So there are things that grow during Shemitah that you didn't plant, and those things are open to the public. You do not have private ownership of your fields during Shemitah. You're not allowed to lock your field. You're not allowed to exclude. Anybody that comes in is entitled to take what they need. You are entitled to take what you need as well. So therefore, Shemitah, there is no institution of giving to the poor, simply because the poor have the freedom to come in and take, along with everybody else. So that's why Shemitah, there is no halacha of the trumot or the masrot. Everything on Shemitah is called hefker. Hefker means ownerless, and people can come in. And to some degree, these laws even apply today, although with a number of complications. We do not give the trumot and the masrot to the Levi or the Kohen today, when there's no Beit HaMikdash, but in the land of Israel, they are still separated. Remember, these are laws that exist only in Israel. They do not apply outside of Israel. So there's still separation that is done, which is why the kashrut problems in Israel are actually stricter than the kashrut problems in the United States. Because in the United States, I can walk into a store and buy an apple without checking if it's kosher. Apples are kosher. But in Israel, one has to determine that the proper tithing was done, or else do it yourself. And that is why there are signs in the Israeli stores that will say, these apples are under the supervision of so-and-so. Again, it's not given to anyone today. It's essentially destroyed. It's thrown away, yeah. There's a certain amount that's thrown away. Yeah, well, yeah, but because of various problems, you can't really give, since all of us are ritually impure today, truma cannot be eaten by someone that's ritually impure.
So therefore, if you can't eat it, well, why separate?
But there's still a mitzvah of separating. The separating and eating are two different mitzvot, and you got to go through the process. By the way, I don't want to, one should consult with whoever they talk about these matters, but that is why there are actually halachic problems with imported Israeli produce. You know, you go to supermarkets.
Jaffa oranges.
They have tomatoes from Israel and the like. Yeah. Halachically, there are certain complications because produce from Israel normally cannot be eaten unless the proper tithing had been done. And although the Israeli chief rabbinate supervises general production, they do not supervise tithing on imported produce. So,
all right, what about the matzah that's shipped over from Israel?
Yes, that is taken care of. Although it depends if it's under supervision. So these are issues. So some people feel that is although it's certainly a mitzvah to support the state of Israel and buy their products and the like. And the truth is, I mean, if one is knowledgeable, one can know how to tie them, and I could tell someone if someone is interested. But the point is that there are no issues. Everything has a problem. So sometimes the Israeli produce is not the best thing to get if it hasn't been tied. Okay. But those are just some of the vocabulary to be aware of. The truma, the maaser rishon, the trumat maaser, the maaser sheni, and the maaser ani. Right, the tithe of the poor, and Sheni and Ani alternates over the 6 years of the cycle. On the seventh year of Shemitah, there are no tithes because everything is available for the poor to come in and take as they need. Now, in addition, there are some other things which you may be familiar with from the Book of Roots. Right, Shavuot is coming up, and that's the concept of gleaning in the fields. And this is, for example, one must leave the corners of their field, the corners of their field unharvested. That is peah, the corner. There is leket, that which drops as one is carrying the sheaves must be left for the poor, etc. And that which is forgotten. In other words, if you forgot to pick up something, you got to leave it. Now, obviously, some of these depend on the honor system, right? A person might come back and say, "I didn't forget. I intended to get," but it's hard to prove these things, but in God's law, that which you forgot, you are obligated to leave for the poor. And that's why we have the specter in Roots about poor people following the harvesters, hoping. It's a hard way to make a living.
Yeah.
It's hard work, you know. You're following the harvester on a long, hot day, hoping to pick up that which gets dropped. but that's how people made a living. In fact, one has even suggested, I once saw what you might regard as a Republican commentary on this, that this was workfare, meaning to say the concept was people who needed these movies courted. This was an institution that allowed them to preserve their dignity because they effectively were working, following the harvesters, trying to pick up the pieces.
But it was useless work. Now, what did the poor people do for money during the years 1, 2, 4, 5, when they were not given nicer money?
Right. Well, keep in mind that the general commandments of charity, of tzedakah, certainly applied. In other words, the particular institution of giving them 10% of my crop, that was not mandatory on years 1, 2, 4, and 5. But there's a mitzvah to support the poor, there's a mitzvah to take care of the poor. In fact, yeah, like we do today. Today we don't give maaser ani, but we help the poor. In fact, one shouldn't confuse this with the idea of giving 10% of your income to charity. Now, although obviously it has a parallel to the 10% of your crop, but that's an independent obligation. It's proper for a Jew to give 10% of their income if they can afford it, you know, if they're not themselves poor. A poor person can actually give himself his charity money. But the Jewish custom is, it's not an absolute law. It's not an absolute law. And, you know, if one has hardship, one can give less. But it is certainly a proper custom to give 10% of your income to charity. And if you look at the average givings of Americans, we see them disappointingly low. Particularly, I think, we've had high people in the government that gave, you know, 2%, 1%, 0.5%, you know. A Jew gives 10%, which is why sometimes Jewish tax returns are audited, because the IRS says this is out of kilter. In fact, ideally, if one can do this, up to 20%, 1/5, is encouraged, although the halakha says you're not allowed to give more than 1/5 unless you're really wealthy, because one has to be concerned for the financial stability of their family. But up to 1/5 is considered to be not mandatory at all, but desirable. In fact, those of you who take the Rambam class with me, you may recall that in Igeret Teiman, where the Rambam discusses a person claiming to be a Mashiach, so the Rambam says this person is mentally deranged because he's calling on people to give up all of their money to charity. And Maimonides makes the point that that is forbidden because you're not supposed to give more than 20%. Remember, the Maimonides actually brings that halakha, which is what we're talking about now. Yeah.
I have to tell you, it's a little bit of a feeling, but I have an uncle who is 96 years old, and he is very wealthy. He still goes to his office. We did.
Yeah.
We visited here 2 years ago.
Right.
At a certain time, at 9 o'clock, he goes down to Belgium Street, you know, Main Street. And, you know, he was sitting there having breakfast with us, and all of a sudden he goes, all got to go. Why? Yeah. Why does he have to go? You know, what does that tell me? He said, there are people waiting for me. Well, who's waiting for you? All along the way, there's people who are waiting for
me. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So please have. No, these are the people that give the doctor. He always has the money in his pocket. And this is how they make a living. Well, they are counting on me to be here at a certain time. And indeed, one time we followed him, he was one person, they all greet him, and they all thank him, and they wish him, you know, he did his shoulder for his blessing.
Well, he is a truly righteous man. I mean, I know myself that I am a synagogue rabbi. I am besought, I am beleaguered by, you know, sometimes 12 people in a day. And it's very, very difficult to be patient and as generous as one should be. And because of financial needs, which are usually genuine, you know, they're not denigrating the need, but, you know, people are often not satisfied with what is given, and people get into shouting matches and other things. Very, just frankly, very... I'm saying it's very unpleasant.
That's right.
Very unpleasant.
That's right. Because in Borough Park, I was at a bar mitzvah for a wedding, and they have a whole bunch of these guys that come in.
Right.
And they're like,
Well, you know, let's put it this way. I certainly understand the frustration, but I have the frustration. But the needs are usually genuine. And, you know, what can you do? I mean, these are very, very difficult situations. But if you would give everybody what everybody wanted, not only would you give 100% of your income, I mean, you would be in deficit spending,
right.
After a week. So, a person has to make some priority and some decision as to how much they could afford. What can I tell you? I mean, there are people that, unless they win the lottery, they will not be able to significantly improve their lives. And it's a difficult, it's a tragic situation sometimes. But the halakha does say that we encourage people to give a 10%, 20% is meritorious, above 20% is considered to be improper, unless one is truly, so wealthy that, if you have billions of dollars, so you can give $1 billion, even if it's, one-fifth of your wealth, because there's enough where that comes from, as it were. But that's a separate chiyuv, that's a mitzvah that exists apart from this particular scheme. And then we have all sorts of issues, by the way. There are very subtle issues in halakha regarding what constitutes as a charity. For example, it may very well be that many contributions to schools that your children attend, if they're religious schools, beyond the basic tuition, would constitute as charitable donations. And it doesn't have to be to what is known as a charity. Institutions of Jewish learning, synagogues, these are considered to be legitimate sources of charity for the maaser requirement. In fact, if you have adult children that you are supporting because they're studying Torah or the like, you can use your charity money for that, because after all, once they're adults, you don't have any mitzvah to support them. So they're like anybody else. You can give them your charity. And in that sense, that can take off the stress. Sometimes people have problems. How can I give 10% to charity if I have 5 children living in Israel, etc.? But the answer is you can use the charity money to help them make a living, because if they don't have, if they can't make ends meet, they're poor. And therefore you can treat them.
I'm sorry. Did I get the impression that Ad Hayom Hazeh, today we are on the third and sixth year required to...
Theoretically, yes. I'm sorry, I take that back. Theoretically, a farmer in Israel in the third and the sixth year will give 10% of his crop to the poor if he's observant.
Well, but not everybody was a farmer in those days. Some people lived in cities and were craftsmen. Were they required to give 10%?
No. This is a requirement that attaches to crops. See, don't confuse this. The present practice that we encourage people to give 10% of their income is a later thing that's building on that. But the institution of Maaser Ani, third and sixth year, only applied to the farmer, only applied to crops, although that is a practice that is carried out today. Okay, but maybe we'll stop here and have a good week, everybody. Next week there's...